Welcome to Making Waves, independent voices for peace and justice, your local connection to the world on WSCA LPFM Portsmouth Community Radio. This is Steve Diamond introducing the show to you today on June 25th, 2005. Here's what's coming up. Today we'll be hearing an interview by Making Waves' Damon Thomas of Shep Gerwitz, a longtime activist for Indigenous rights. They will particularly discuss Leonard Pelletier's case, since June 26 marks the 30th anniversary of the Pine Ridge Shootout, which led to Leonard's imprisonment. Our second hour features Growing Up Queer in New Hampshire, a piece by Jennifer Belkis. After following the Portsmouth-based gay, lesbian, transgender, and questioning support organization, Seacoast Outright, in celebrating June's Youth Pride in Boston, Jennifer asks, "What is our home state doing for our queer youth?" We'll end with Between the Lines, independent radio from Connecticut. We'll also bring you music, a bit of people's history, announcements, and more. First, here's the news. This is Steve Diamond with the news. Our first story is from the Associated Press. UN human rights investigators, citing, quote, persistent and credible reports of torture at the U.S. base in Guantanamo Bay, urged the United States on Thursday to allow them to check conditions there. The failure of the United States to respond to requests since early 2002 is leading the experts to conclude Washington has something to hide at the Cuban base, said Manfred Nowak, a specialist on torture and a professor of human rights law in Vienna, Austria. For more than 3 years, UN investigators have made numerous requests to visit foreign terror suspects at the U.S. naval base in Cuba and at U.S. facilities in Iraq, Afghanistan, and elsewhere, the four independent specialists told reporters. The experts said, "We deeply regret that the government of the United States has still not invited us to visit those persons arrested, detained, or tried on grounds of alleged terrorism or other violations." The four experts, who report to UN bodies on different human rights issues, are appointed to their 3-year terms by the 53-nation UN Human Rights Commission, the global body's top rights watchdog. The four cited, quote, "information from reliable sources of serious allegations of torture, cruel, inhuman and degrading treatment of detainees, arbitrary detention, violations of their rights to health and their due process." They said, "Many of these allegations have come to light through declassified U.S. government documents." The specialists said they had yet to hear back from Washington on their latest request, made a year ago and renewed in mid-April, to visit the detention facility. And next, from the Christian Science Monitor, in a startling example of mixed messages, General John Abizaid, the top U.S. commander in the Persian Gulf, gave testimony to Congress Thursday that directly contradicted recent statements by the Vice President and the Secretary of Defense. Canada's Globe and Mail reported that General Abizaid, quote, "conceded yesterday that the Iraqi insurgency is as strong as it was 6 months ago," countering declarations by Vice President Dick Cheney that the revolt is, quote, "in its last throes." General Abizaid said, "In terms of the overall strength of the insurgency, I'd say it's about the same as it was." He declined to specifically criticize Mr. Cheney's upbeat assessment of the continuing conflict. General Abizaid also said that there are more foreign fighters entering Iraq today than there were 6 months ago. On Wednesday, a declassified CIA document that was leaked to the media showed that the war in Iraq is becoming an urban warfare training ground for many of those foreign fighters. Abizaid raised another key issue, public support of the war in Iraq. The Boston Globe reports that he warned the troops about starting to worry about public support for the war. A recent CNN poll shows that the public support for the war is as low as it's ever been. 39% of Americans still believe the U.S. should be fighting in Iraq. The Globe and Mail also reports that U.S. politicians are starting to see evidence of this swing in support even in solidly red states. "Public support in my state is turning," said Senator Lindsey Graham of South Carolina, part of the heartland of Bush support. "People are beginning to question, and I don't think it's a blip on the radar screen." The Guardian reported on a bold attack earlier this week by the Iraqi resistance against Baghdad's largest police station and the effect it had on the inhabitants of the city. Residents said their confidence in the government and security forces was severely dented. A rash of graffiti had spread across the area. "We will be back," it said. CNN reports the new poll taken by the Pew Research Center for the People and the Press shows that the image of the United States, quote, "is so tattered overseas 2 years after the Iraq invasion that communist China is viewed more favorably than the U.S., even in many countries that have been longtime Western European allies." Also in U.S. News Report, Senator Chuck Hagel said that the administration's Iraq policy is failing. He said, quote, "Things aren't getting better, they're getting worse. The White House is completely disconnected from reality." Senator Hagel is a member of the Foreign Relations Committee. He added, "It's like they're just making it up as they go along. The reality is that we're losing in Iraq." And next, from the International Herald Tribune, reporting from Moscow. Uzbek law enforcement and security ministries implicated by witnesses in a deadly crackdown in the city of Andijan last month have for years received training and equipment from counterterrorism programs run by the United States, according to American officials and congressional records. Witnesses and American officials say that the Uzbek army, law enforcement and intelligence service were all present at the crackdown. Among them was a special internal affairs counterterrorism unit known as BARS, which has two or three members who were trained in a course sponsored by the U.S. State Department for crisis response commanders in Louisiana in 2004, according to the State Department. Hundreds of civilians were killed when Uzbek forces fired into dense crowds on May 13th, according to survivors and human rights organizations. The crackdown, which the Uzbek government has described as a counterterrorism operation, crushed an anti-government rally that was prompted by an armed uprising and a prison break. The Uzbek government has said that 173 people were killed. The United States has worked closely with Uzbekistan, a corrupt and autocratic state with a chilling human rights record, in the fight against international terrorism. And next from the LA Times. The public war on the Iraqi resistance has led to an atmosphere of hidden brutalities, including abuse and torture, carried out against detainees by the nation's special security forces, according to defense lawyers, international organizations, and Iraq's Ministry of Human Rights. Up to 60% of the estimated 12,000 detainees in the country's prison and military compounds face intimidation, beatings, and torture that leads to broken bones and sometimes death, said Saad Sultan, head of a board overseeing the treatment of prisoners at the Human Rights Ministry. The units have used tactics reminiscent of Saddam Hussein's secret intelligence squads, according to the ministry and independent human rights groups and lawyers who have catalogued abuses. Sultan said, "We've documented a lot of torture cases." His committee is pushing for wider access to Iraqi-run prisons across the nation. He added, "There are beatings, punchings, electric shocks to the body, including sensitive areas, hanging prisoners upside down and beating them and dragging them on the ground. Many police officers come from a culture of torture from their experiences over the last 35 years. Most of them worked under Saddam's regime." And from the LA Times, reporting from Jacksonville, North Carolina. With its sprawling military bases and huge population of military retirees, eastern North Carolina has believed in the Iraq War and sacrificed for it like few other regions. This month, Republican Representative Walter B. Jones, an original supporter of the war, said he had lost confidence in the effort and would sponsor legislation calling on the administration to more clearly define how and when it intended to bring the war to a close. This is coming from a staunch conservative who renamed French fries Freedom Fries on congressional menus. This announcement shocked many. Service members' families, watching violence surge, fear it will drag on indefinitely. Others worry it is damaging the military, or that it has been prosecuted foolishly. Retired Marine Colonel Jim Van Ripper said Jones was right to go after the administration. He's a veteran of Vietnam and Desert Storm who supported the U.S. presence in Iraq but faulted the war plan. He added, "Rumsfeld and the neocons have fouled it up from the beginning." And next from the AP. In the long run, the most powerful weapon of the Iraqi resistance may be one that is practically silent, a vast network of infiltrators, spies, and recruiters. According to intelligence officials in Baghdad, whose clearances bar them from speaking publicly, Iraq's security services have hundreds of ghost soldiers, members who vanish, sometimes for months on end, but continue to draw their pay. The fear is that they are working for the insurgency while keeping up their ties in uniform. And from Reuters? Despite reported successes against the Iraqi resistance in Iraq, a top U.S. military commander said on Tuesday the United States was unlikely to reduce its 135,000 troops there before elections late this year. And from the Associated Press, reporting from Tehran, Iran. Iran's spy chief used just two words to respond to White House ridicule of last week's presidential election. "Thank you." His sarcasm was barely hidden. The sharp barbs from President Bush were widely seen in Iran as damaging to pro-reform groups because the comments appeared to have boosted turnout among hardliners in Friday's election. Bush's comments, blasting the ruling clerics for blocking, quote, "basic requirements of democracy," became a lively sideshow in Iran's closest election since the 1979 Islamic Revolution, and they highlighted again the United States' often cross-wired efforts to isolate Iran. In 2002, most Iranians were indignant when Bush placed their nation in an axis of evil with North Korea and Saddam Hussein's Iraq. Since then, U.S. pressure over Iran's nuclear program has put even liberal Iranians on the defensive. Even many opponents of the Islamic establishment objected to Bush's tone and timing. According to Abdullah Momeni, a political affairs expert at Tehran University, the president's words sounded too much like the pre-war rhetoric against Saddam, and many on-the-fence voters were shocked into action. And as it turned out, shortly after that report was released, the hardliner candidate in Iran won the election by a landslide. And that's all we have for the news today. Next, we'll hear Sacrifice by Robbie Robertson and Leonard Peltier.
You know, we have a million stories to tell. I'm just one of a million or more stories that could be told.
Freedom.
is nothing compared to what our people of 100 years ago or 50 years ago or 25 years ago made. Some gave their lives. Some had to stand there and watch their children die in their arms. So I mean, the sacrifice I made is nothing compared to those. I've gone too far now to start backing down. I don't give up. Not until my people are free will I give up. And if I have to sacrifice some more, then I sacrifice some more.
Good afternoon. My name is Damon Thomas, and I'll be hosting this segment of Making Waves here on WSCALP 106.1 FM, Portsmouth Community Radio. For the next several minutes, we'll be exploring the case of imprisoned Native American Leonard Peltier, who Amnesty International long ago designated a political prisoner. I urge our listeners to continue to tune in to what promises to be a most interesting and engaging discussion on a very important case that is unfortunately not covered by the mainstream media. My guest today is Shep Gerwitz, a longtime activist for indigenous and human rights who has traveled across New England, across the nation, and internationally in the pursuit of justice for Leonard Peltier and for Native peoples. Shep, welcome to Making Waves.
Hi, Damon. How are you today?
Thanks, Shep. Let me begin, if I could, by providing some background to Leonard's case. We're discussing his case because tomorrow, June 26th, is the 30th anniversary of the event that gave rise to his imprisonment. But his capture, trial, and subsequent conviction have to be understood in a wider context, and in that we need to examine certain events of the time. And I go back to the start of the American Indian Movement, or AIM, which was begun to empower American Indians through the examination of treaty rights, to educate youth in traditional life ways, and to help those charged to learn their rights and create a defense for court hearings. Leonard Peltier quickly became trusted by AIM and worked as a community counselor confronting unemployment, alcohol problems, and poor housing in Denver, Colorado, and later joined the Trail of Broken Treaties before going to Wounded Knee, South Dakota. On February 27, 1973, members of AIM, together with a number of local and traditional Native Americans, began their 72-day occupation of Wounded Knee. Their goal was to protest injustices against their tribes, violations of the many treaties and current abuses and repression against their people. The United States government responded with a military-style assault against the protesters. In the end, various officials promised hearings on local conditions and treaty violations. These hearings were never convened. The use of military force by the U.S. government was later ruled unlawful. And throughout the next 3 years, long referred to by local Native Americans as the Reign of Terror, the FBI carried out intensive local surveillance as well as the repeated arrests, harassment, and bad faith legal proceedings against AIM leaders and supporters. The FBI also closely collaborated with and supported the local tribal chairperson, Dick Wilson, and his select vigilantes, the guardians of the Ogallala Nation, or quite literally, the goons. Mr. Wilson was notorious for his corruption and abuse of power. And during this reign of terror, at least 64 local Native Americans were murdered. 300 were beaten and harassed and otherwise abused. All of the victims were either affiliated with AIM or their allies, the traditional tribe members. The FBI had jurisdiction to investigate major crimes, yet these deaths were never adequately investigated or resolved, nor did FBI agents take any measures to curb the violence of goons with whom they were closely collaborating. On June 26, 1975, two FBI agents, Mr. Jack Kohler and Mr. Ron Williams, entered the Jumping Bull Ranch, which was private property. They allegedly sought to arrest a young Native American man, Jimmy Eagle, who they believed stole a pair of cowboy boots. A large number of AIM supporters were camping on the property, invited by the Jumping Bull elders, who as traditional sought protection from the FBI and Dick Wilson's goons. No one knows who began shooting first between AIM supporters and the agents, and cries could be heard from people screaming they were under attack, and many hurried to return fire. When the skirmish ended, two FBI agents and a native were dead, and today the United States Attorney admits that no one knows who fired the fatal shots. The more than 30 AIM men, women, mostly in their late teens, and children present on the ranch that day were surrounded by over 150 FBI agents, SWAT team members, BIA police, and local posse members within an hour or so of the first gunfire. The FBI attack had apparently been planned. And later, in Freedom of Information Act documents, maps of the Jumping Bull Ranch made prior to the shootout had barn and outbuildings listed as bunkers. Leonard Peltier was one of several high-level AIM leaders present during the shootout. Murder charges were brought against him as well as three others, and none of them thought they could receive a fair trial in the United States. At the trial of Dino Butler, the jury found two defendants in his trial not guilty on grounds of self-defense. They found that there was no evidence to link the defendants to the fatal shots, and moreover, the exchange of gunfire from a distance was deemed to have constituted an act of self-defense. Leonard Pelletier was extradited from Canada on the basis of an affidavit signed by a Myrtle Poorbear, a local Native American woman known to have serious mental problems. She claimed to have been Mr. Pelletier's girlfriend at the time, to have been present during the shootout, and to have witnessed the murders. In fact, she did not know Mr. Pelletier, nor was she present at the time of the shooting. She later confessed she had been pressured and terrorized by FBI agents, one of whom had also been involved in the falsification of testimony in an earlier notable FBI trial. Myrtle Poorbear sought to testify in this regard at Mr. Pelletier's trial, and the judge barred her testimony on the grounds of mental incompetence. Myrtle Poorbear had also been forced to sign a similar affidavit against yet another local Native American named Dick Marshall. Again, she claimed to have been his girlfriend and linked him to a separate murder. This, too, she recanted. No known witnesses exist as to the actual shooting of the FBI agents Calder and Williams. Three adolescents gave inconclusive and vague testimonies contradicting their own earlier statements as well as each other's. All three witnesses admitted they had been seriously threatened and intimidated by FBI agents. At Leonard's trial, the FBI ballistics expert Evan Hodge testified he had been unable to perform the best firing pin test on certain casings found near the agent's car because the rifle in question had been damaged in a fire. Instead, he stated he had conducted an extractor mark test and found the casing and weapon to match. Years later, documents that lawyers obtained for Leonard through the Freedom of Information Act showed that in October 1975, a firing pin ballistic test had indeed been performed on the rifle and that the results were clearly negative. In short, the fatal bullet did not come from Leonard Pelletier's weapon. The jury never heard about any of these crucial issues. And equally disturbing are the numerous discrepancies regarding the key vehicle in the case. Agents William and Kohler had radioed that they were chasing a red pickup truck, which they believed was transporting a suspect. The chase led to the Jumping Bull Ranch and the fatal shootout. At trial, however, the evidence had changed to describe a red and white van, quite a different vehicle, and which, not coincidentally, was more easily linked to Leonard Pelletier. The court at Mr. Pelletier's murder trial did not permit the jury to learn of the FBI's pattern and practice of using false affidavits and of intimidating witnesses in recent related cases. The jury was thus unable to properly evaluate the prosecution witness's testimony. In the trials of other AIM leaders, such evidence had been admitted. There was no witness testimony that Leonard Pelletier actually shot the two FBI agents. There was no witness testimony that placed Mr. Pelletier near the crime scene before the murders occurred. Those witnesses placing Pelletier and two other defendants, Robidoux and Butler, near the crime scene after the killing were coerced and intimidated by the FBI. There was no forensic evidence as to the exact type of rifle used to commit the murders. Several different weapons present in the area during the shootout could have caused fatal injuries. There was more than one AR-15 in the area at the time of the shootout. The AR-15 rifle claimed to be Mr. Pelletier's was found to be incompatible with the bullet casings near the agent's car. Although other bullets were fired at the crime scene, no other casings or evidence about them were offered by the prosecutor. In short, there was no reasonable evidence that Mr. Pelletier committed the murders. Instead, there was very strong evidence of FBI misconduct. Some 6,000 FBI documents are still being withheld in their entirety from Mr. Leonard Pelletier, as are some 5,000 partial documents. There is clearly no current reason to fear national security risks or the disruption of ongoing investigations. Moreover, based on the critical nature of those documents which have been disclosed, such as the ballistic test reports, it is reasonable to conclude that the remaining files would contain evidence that would help to establish Leonard Pelletier's innocence, and the situation violates his rights to the access of the courts and to a fair trial. That's been a point that's been established by numerous human rights groups across the world. I should note also, Shep, that at the Pelletier trial, the prosecutor claimed in summation that we prove that he went down to the bodies and executed those two young men at point-blank range. At the appellate hearing, the government attorney concluded, we had a murder, we had numerous shooters, we did not know who specifically fired what killing shots, we do not know, quote-unquote, who shot the agents. At the murder trial, the prosecutor, referring to the murder weapon, stated that there was only one AR-15 in the group. There was no testimony concerning any other AR-15 at the crime scene or anywhere else in the area. Mr. Pelletier's lawyers later filed a habeas corpus petition, claiming that the government had misled the jury by concealing evidence of other AR-15 rifles, and thus other potential murder weapons at the crime scene. The same prosecuting attorney before the Eighth Circuit Court in 1992 claimed that, I think it's simply a misstatement of the trial, that there was no evidence presented and it was suppressed as to other AR-15s at the scene. Leonard Pelletier was convicted of murder on April 18, 1977, and later sentenced to two consecutive life terms. He's now served more than 28 years in prison. Shep, I think you have a somewhat unique perspective to the events that occurred 30 years ago tomorrow and in the days following that. because you were in the area of the site not long after the shootings, and I'm wondering if you can give to our listeners your unique perspective on the events of that time. What was it that brought you out there, and what was the political and social climate like? What are the conditions on the reservation that would have given rise to a people who have had to band together to resist literally the government, sort of government onslaught that I've described?
Well, that's a big question, Damon. In 1973, I went out to work in Council Bluffs, Iowa, with a group called the Wounded Knee Legal Defense Offense Committee, and it was in direct response to the occupation of Wounded Knee in 1973. What prompted Wounded Knee, I believe, was the frustration and desperation of a people trying to eke out a living on an unforgiving land under government policies that denied them opportunities to advance themselves as a community and as a people. Now, a woman named Ellen Moveskamp one day asked the question, where are the warriors? And that prompted people to move on to the site at Wounded Knee. Out of Wounded Knee came a great surge amongst Native people, especially young Native people, to feel proud about who they were and who they are as a people. Proud against an education system that oftentimes cast them as savages hiding in the woods to ambush innocent white people. Now, Leonard Peltier is a man, only a man, but he's been built into some type of a major celebrity. And that unfortunately works against him because he's only a man who seeks freedom, to live amongst his people, to hug his children and his grandchildren, to walk Mother Earth as a free man on his own land, unencumbered. Frustration can bring out all types of responses. We are living in frustrating times now, and the responses that our government utilizes to show us frustration is one of violence. Violence that pervades our society, smothers us like a blanket. And Leonard Peltier was forced to respond to violence, as were the other people encamped on the Jumping Wolf property, which resulted in the death of Agent Coyle and Agent Williams and a man named Joe Stuns Kilsright. Nobody to this day has ever investigated the death of Joe Stuns Kilsright. Nobody ever really cared too much about the 64 to 67 unsolved and uninvestigated homicides in Pine Ridge. The conditions out there are horrible. Today, life expectancy is 47 years. Suicide is prevalent. Alcoholism endemic. Poverty, lack of resources, lack of adequate diet. All these are the daily bread of the Lakota people living on Pine Ridge Reservation in South Dakota. Leonard Peltier was never found guilty on any evidence that was presented, so in essence he was found guilty on circumstantial evidence. Lynn Crook, the federal prosecutor, said, "We don't know who killed those agents," and Leonard Peltier was in prison as a result of that lack of knowledge. This is not justice, this is injustice. And each and every person listening to this program should take that to heart, that we live in a society that is unjust, uncivil, and inhumane as it relates to poor people and to the indigenous population of Mother Earth. We have a responsibility as human beings to investigate the injustice that was enacted on Pine Ridge Reservation on June 26, 1975, and demand the freedom of Leonard Peltier, a man who was unjustly serving two life sentences in Leavenworth Federal Penitentiary. There have been assassination attempts against Leonard Peltier. There's been a manufacturing of evidence, a hiding of evidence, a hiding of every type of thing that might indicate that he was not the perpetrator. What was the national security issue in 1975 when a small group like the American Indian Movement existed, asking only for recognition of the treaty violations that our government perpetrated against indigenous people since the United States' inception and asking for justice in the courts? That's what the issues really are, the issues of human rights, religious freedom, a right to own the resources on your own land, a right to be treated humanely in the educational system of the United States of America, and to be given justice in its courts. That's what the protests are all about, and nothing more.
Shep, Pine Ridge Reservation, among other things, is a certainly a sprawling locale. It's not near any urban centers. It's quite remote and quite removed. Yet, according to information I've gathered from the Leonard Peltier Defense Committee, the search that ensued following the shootout on June 26, 1975, involved what might very well still be, or certainly was at the time, the largest manhunt in FBI history. How is it possible that in such a remote place, literally, as I've described, hundreds of FBI agents, BIA agents, and other federal officials, technically, really, literally within minutes of the shooting, happened to have descended upon this remote territory to extract what the committee has described as their own certain form of justice?
Not only is Pine Ridge isolated and far removed from any major city, it has no stores. It has no industry. It is virtually impossible for people to get onto the Pine Ridge Reservation from any direction in as quick of a response time as these vigilantes, federal agents, FBI agents, drug enforcement agents, and all other types of special agents. So the evidence would dictate, logic would dictate, that they were already there, in place, somewhere removed from the scene, but close enough to respond in a quick time. I can't comprehend, to this day, and I've been involved in this since 1973, and it's now the year 2005, and I've spent most of my adult life doing this type of activism, I can't understand how the American public that's aware of this case aren't enraged by the injustice and also by the continued incarceration of Leonard, who is getting older and older and older in jail, and his health is failing him. So not only is this a plea to people to wake up and look at the facts and determine for themselves that injustice was enacted in their names, but it's also a plea from a humane aspect to save this man's life, an innocent man serving two life sentences in federal prison for a crime that our government admits they don't know who committed the act. So this is a plea for me also, as a longtime supporter of Leonard Peltier, and as a brother of one of Leonard's lawyers who passed away years ago at the age of 56, and who fought fervently on a day-to-day basis to free his friend and his brother Leonard Peltier, I ask you to also join in this, not in a violent way, but in a participatory way, to bring about the freedom of this innocent man, and also to bring ourselves a step closer to having justice in our society.
Certainly in the course of the last two-plus decades, I know that legal proceedings have occurred. There have been petitions seeking Leonard's clemency, clemency for Leonard, which is a grant by the president of a pardon for any convictions. Can you describe this? And there's certainly been reference in my earlier introductory remarks to habeas corpus proceedings. Can you summarize what's been done in the last couple of decades and where that's led to and where we find ourselves today?
Well, you're the lawyer, but I'll try the best as I can. I think that the courts have been unfriendly towards Leonard Peltier's case over the past, actually, three decades now that they've been in court with Leonard, that there are occurrences where judges that decided against him in retrospect have decided that he didn't get a fair trial. But ultimately, it's the courts that imprisoned him, and it's the courts that are trying to keep him there. At whose behest, I'm not certain, but I think that if you think it thoroughly through, you can come to your own determinations. But the courts aren't acting fairly. Justice is supposed to be blind, and federal prosecutors are not supposed to want to pin skins against the wall. They're supposed to be objective in their deliberations and determinations. And Lynn Crook is anything but objective, and the legal team that put Leonard Peltier into prison really are culpable of misconduct in many, many different areas, and they have to answer to themselves for that. But once again, I'm not going to let you off the hook, my friends out here who I'm speaking to, because it's our responsibility to make them accountable for their actions. We can't be so concerned with our own materialist needs in a time when the world is telling you that that's the reason in which they're angry at you, because you exploit the resources of the world with a grandiose attitude as if you have all rights and expectations to these things. That's what happened throughout the history of this country, that people screamed about how they were being adversely affected by colonialism, by the westward movement. They were screaming their outrage at the complete lack of respect that some people seem to have for all the other inhabitants of this land. But we all live on Mother Earth together, and if we can't learn to live together in a harmonious way, then we're going to have to suffer the consequences of our lack of involvement in what really goes on a day-to-day basis. Our lack of involvement in demanding that justice be the basis on which everything is predicated. So all of the antipathies and angers and hatreds and all the violence and misunderstanding can be addressed and hopefully brought to a peaceful conclusion. But as long as we exploit each other and commodify each other and think that we have absolute rights to other people's lands and to destroy their cultures and their religious beliefs, then it's going to be a long, hard road for us. And when we look for justice, remember that we allowed injustice to reign. Because what we see today is a direct growth of COINTELPRO, which was the orchestrated denial of movements that were looking for redress. The American Indian Movement, the Black Panther Party, the Brown Berets, and all other types of movements that were looking for redress to their grievances were infiltrated, were attacked, were violated, were imprisoned, or murdered. Now this, today, Homeland Security and the Patriot Acts 1 and 2 seem to be the same description of what I'm just delineating about what COINTELPRO was about. So we need to address this also because your rights are being taken away from you. And the way they're being taken away from you is by a reign of terror. A reign of terror in a larger magnitude than the reign of terror that existed on Pine Ridge from 1973 to 1976.
Well, in part, one of the incidents that gave rise to really the whole Pelletier case was the fact that, as the Defense Committee and other Leonard supporters have pointed out over the years, in the spring of 75, disputes were building on the Pine Ridge Reservation over the Black Hills, which is Lakota territory, and strip mining. Multinational corporations wanted to prospect Pine Ridge, particularly the northwest corner of the reservation, which was rich in uranium. And you had Tribal Chairman Dick Wilson, who supported the efforts, and traditional natives were very much against the prospecting. And the controversy effectively pitted the traditional natives against the non-traditional factions led by Chairman Dick Wilson. And needless to say, at the time of the shooting, tensions were running high in the reservation. And it strikes me as not coincidental then on the same day of the shooting, Dick Wilson was over in another corner of the reservation signing over some one-eighth of the reservation, a portion of which was highly rich in mineral deposits, including the uranium I referred to.
Well, I see tremendous similarities between what took place then and what's taking place now, but in a larger area of the earth. There are always going to be those who want to hold on to their traditions and their ways of life, who want to preserve the dignity of the earth and the relationship to it. And then there were those that want to sweep them aside. And Dick Wilson capitulated with the ideology that wants to sweep aside people that maintain their culture, their traditional values, and their way of relating to Mother Earth. We are aware that today, peak oil production has already been reached, and that we're fighting for the scarce resources left to plunder from the earth. We do things without responsibility. When Dick Wilson signed over that 133,000 acres of Pine Ridge, he did that illegally, and yet that land is still in the government's control. When they investigated whether or not there were uranium deposits on the reservation, they dug holes in the earth and left them uncapped, and it irradiated the groundwater and the grass on which cattle grazed. This was one of the first times in the history of the state of South Dakota that whites and native people came together and formed the South Dakota Alliance to fight against this. But unfortunately, we all bow down to mammon in this society, and that's orchestrated in its own self. And we all have to fight for a wage to support ourselves. And that draws us away from having the extra time to make that sacrifice of extra time to go out and do the things that will bring about what we're all striving for, which is a just society, a society in which all people can live with dignity. We've tried to strip away that dignity from the indigenous people of North America, but there's a great, great, great feeling of dignity amongst these oppressed people. You can imprison Native men and sterilize Native women, but you're not going to eliminate that Native spirit that a lot of people living in North America have in the relationship to the earth. We have to find other ways to assure that there will be a balance on this planet that will allow life to live, because we are not needed as a species. No species on this earth is so needed that the earth can't continue without it. And I hope to God that we're not digging our own grave. We have to be more conscious of what we do, and we have to be more responsible and accountable for how we act. The imprisonment of Leonard Peltier is just the tip of the iceberg of injustice that pervades our society. A society should be measured by how few people are impoverished, and not by how rich a certain few can become. A just society is a society that cares for all of its citizens. An unjust society is a society that is only based on acquisition and false power. Yes, you can control the food and you can control the water, but that's control. Nature has power. So when you control another human, you enslave that human being. So in our country that abolished slavery in the 1860s, we should take a look at how many, many people in this culture are still enslaved. We have the key to unlock the doors of all those that are oppressed by an injustice that's been given against them by the federal courts and the state courts. We need to want that justice. I'm a human rights activist. I'm a political activist. I'm a member of Veterans for Peace. And as a member of Veterans for Peace, I think we have to find what the definition of peace is. That we have to come together as people that have fought in wars, people that have stood up against oppression, and develop a definition of what is peace. for the largest number of people and work towards that to define how we relate to each other as human beings on this earth.
Shep, your late brother Lou was an attorney. He was an attorney who was well known in Native circles. He traveled the country, and he was known in those circles as a fire starter, as somebody who kept the fires going in from locale to locale, from different places and different places, kept different struggles going. Everywhere he touched and the lives he touched inspired people to keep a particular struggle going in a particular area. Lou had that energy and that spirit about him. He was Lenin's lawyer, one of Lenin's lawyers for many years, and he fought tirelessly for Lenin's freedom. And I think you know that better than most people. And a lot of listeners in the Seacoast area might very well have heard Lou speak at one point or another at some point along the way. Lou almost single-handedly directed particular drives for Lenin's freedom. One of those drives included a petition for executive clemency, and that campaign lasted actually for a number of years. Technically, it's still out there, even though it hasn't been pursued very aggressively, in my estimation, since about the year 2000 when Clinton surrendered the office to George Bush, one way or the other. The question is, where do we stand today in Lenin's case, and where can we, as a collective group of people across this nation, go in terms of the next direction? What can be done for Lenin? What can you suggest to the people who are listening to the show? What can be done for Lenin? And by the way, I do want to remind our listeners that you are listening to 106.1 FM, WSCA, LP, Portsmouth Community Radio. My guest today is Shep Gerwitz, and we're talking about the case of Lenin Peltier.
Well, I think that right after Lenin was denied clemency in the year 2000, there was sort of a stepping back. People were dumbfounded. They were knocked off their feet, and they didn't respond by continuing the efforts that brought us this close to clemency. I believe that what everyone can do is to educate themselves on a day-to-day basis, put aside time to look at the issues, and then find a way that you can incorporate a solution to the problem on a day-to-day basis. Lenin will be free when enough people are speaking about him, and enough people care enough about the injustice that imprisoned him to fight against it. My brother Lou was indeed a fire starter, but he died at a very early age. He died at 56. He died penniless. Me and my brothers had to bury him, and it hurt. But he believed in justice. And it wasn't just his relationship with Lenin. It was the idea that he couldn't support as a lawyer a system that acted unjustly and worked against the people it was supposed to benefit. Lou hated lawyers because he thought they were corrupt and self-serving. And Lou was a selfless man in a lot of ways. When he passed, a woman who was a close friend said it was too bad that Lou couldn't take back what he gave to people, that nurturance, that sense of hope, the caring, the indefatigable efforts he made at the suspending of everything else in his life to free Lenin Peltier is admirable. And I don't just say this as his brother, I say it as a fellow activist. I admire the man because he had a strong, stubborn idea about wanting to see justice. And he stood up for the small person, always, often with no money being paid to him, often sleeping on a floor and eating hot dogs and fry bread and white bread, and not taking the time to replenish himself because he was always on the move. He traveled this country like you would go from Boston to New Hampshire, constantly on the move, putting thousands and thousands and thousands of miles in his car to keep an awareness around the case of Lenin Peltier and injustices especially directed towards indigenous people. That's what we have to do. I don't ask anybody to do it independently, to take the total burden upon themselves, but I ask you to put together a collective effort to raise consciousness amongst your neighbors, your family, your fellow members in your churches, your synagogues, your mosques, to drive home that we live in a country that says that it believes in God. Well, I also believe in God, but I also believe that God doesn't have a religion, and that we should all be allowed to pray to God in our own ways. But today the times are troublous, and we have the ability to stop what we see happening in front of our very eyes. All it takes is a desire to do that. You know, Damon, to conclude this, because we've been talking a long time and we don't want to bore the audience, what needs to be done now, I believe, is that the fires need to be rekindled. That there has been a long delay in strategies to free Lenin Peltier that have let the public lose its commitment to freeing this man. We've gathered over 20 million signatures on petitions worldwide over the last 25 years that I can recall. I haven't been very prominent in the last 5 years, so I can't speak accurately. But we have that much of an audience. We have hundreds of celebrities that support Lenin Peltier. There are religious leaders, government heads, there are internationally known humanitarians that desire Lenin Peltier's freedom. Amnesty International regards him as a political prisoner. And yet, we haven't connected and consolidated our energies to have one strong, concerted, energetic effort to free this man that sustains itself regardless of what takes place in the political arena. Because we've lost momentum, and we need to rebuild that momentum. So I'm asking you, none of whom I know, to listen to a man who has spent most of his adult life sacrificed relationships with his children, his own education, his opportunities for employment, because like his brother, he saw an injustice and tried to understand how it was that it could happen in a society that is seen in the world as a cradle of liberty and justice and freedom. We have over 2 million people imprisoned right now in the United States of America. That's a tremendous drain of resources that could be better served to create a healthy and harmonious society for all of us to live in. We can no longer allow injustice to be considered normal in our society. We can't allow these egregious disparities between the very wealthy and the very poor. And the very poor's numbers are growing on a day-to-day basis. We can't allow poverty to exist in our society, or racism, or all of these cancers that erode the ability for human beings to reach their fullest potential and live with dignity amongst their brothers and sisters of the creation and of Mother Earth. Now, I know that some of my language seems to be native in sound, but it comes from my tradition also. I'm a Jewish man who was told to be a light unto the nations. That means to let justice shine, to be a member of a society that expounds the principles of justice and fairness. And I fight with my rabbis, and I fight with all people that are indifferent to that cognition that we're all part of the creation and should have equal access to the created. So I ask you to think about Leonard Peltier, to call the Leonard Peltier Defense Committee office in Lawrence, Kansas, and Damon will supply with the phone number, and ask them how you can be a participant in this movement that we hope will grow and grow as more people become aware to free Leonard Peltier and to demand justice for each and every one of us living in North America. Thank you.
Shep, I want to thank you on behalf of Making Waves. You've been listening to Shep Gerwitz here on Making Waves at Portsmouth Community Radio, 106.1 FM, WSCALP. I'm Damon Thomas. Our guest has been Shep Gerwitz, and we've been talking about the case of Leonard Peltier. Thanks for joining us today, and I'll be back next week.
Oh, shame on you.
That was Peyote Healing by Robbie Robertson. Next, we have a People's History segment on the history of the Stonewall Inn with Andrew Dolkart, historic preservationist for the website Interior Globe. The Stonewall Rebellion that began on June 28, 1969 at the Stonewall Inn is the watershed moment in the history of the modern gay and lesbian civil rights movement. Stonewall marked the first time that gays and lesbians as a group forcefully and vocally asserted their rights to equality under the law. The events of Stonewall opened the door for millions of gay and lesbian Americans to begin pressing for full and equal civil rights. Indeed, within a few short years of Stonewall, thousands of gay and lesbian civil rights organizations had sprung up all across America. This historic site, that is commemorated annually in thousands of parades and festivals around the world, must be recognized as a truly significant place in the history of the modern civil rights movement. In June 1999, the Stonewall Inn was listed on the National Register of Historic Places for its historic significance to gay and lesbian history. The Stonewall Inn in 1969 was a mafia-run private club that catered to a young, collegiate crowd, but was diversified and somewhat interracial. Although men in drag are often mentioned in connection with Stonewall, at the time, men dressing in women's clothing was illegal, and drag usually meant a little eye makeup or maybe a little accessorizing. Christopher Park, across the street from Stonewall Inn, was a gathering place for young gay street kids. At 1 a.m. on Saturday morning, the New York City police raided the Stonewall Inn. The usual practice was for patrons with membership cards to be released from the bar, one at a time. Employees of the inn and patrons in drag would be arrested. Usually, during raids, members would leave the area when released by the police, but on this morning, they stayed around. The event received much press attention, and the next night, over 1,000 people were on hand to join in the fray. 3 nights of bad weather, which halted the activities, were followed by a few more nights of rebellion, characterized by a more diverse crowd, rock-throwing and vandalism. The event was significant from the day it occurred, creating changes in gay people's lives immediately. On the one-week anniversary, there was a gay march. On the first-year anniversary, the first gay pride march was held in New York City, as well as in other cities. The name Stonewall has been used very widely, even internationally, to mark gay pride events. An estimated crowd of more than 500,000 people participated in the 25th anniversary Stonewall March in New York City. At 30 years, Stonewall was listed on the National Register of Historic Places, recognizing the significance of the events which took place in 1969. To hear our previous shows, please visit our archive online at www.freewebs.com/sbrav/audio.htm. You can email us at nhmakingwaves@yahoo.com and let us know what you think of the show. And feel free to call the station in the next hour for more information. 430-9722.